Hello and welcome to Angel's Costumes Behind the Seams. I'm Jeremy Angel.
I'm Richard Green.
And I'm Jonathan Lippman. Today I'm thrilled that we've got the opportunity to present our interview with David Davenport. He's a North American costume designer, originally hailing from Baltimore. And there's a very key reason why I say that. You'll have to hear the interview in order to find out more. He's somebody who I've known for many years through work, and he's a very kind, understanding, intelligent chap.
And all of that really comes out in the interview. He sounds like a really nice guy.
What I found really refreshing is he seems to put the well-being of people front and centre. He wants a happy crew, a happy department. And I think having a person who cares about that in the film industry, who genuinely wants it, is so refreshing to hear.
Yeah.
Well, he acknowledges that he is the vital link between the artistic element of the costume design team and then the logistical process with regards filmmaking and how complex it can be. And his experience over many years working for, in my opinion, some of the toughest designers that are around working today, you know, including Anne Roth and Colleen and Sandy Powell. And I think that it's important that we acknowledge the fact that experience in this business is everything. And when you are experienced and you completely understand the world that you're working within, you can then solve problems and you can be solution orientated because you've had the experience to reference against.
And it's not just experience on big productions. He's worked on big productions, small productions, and it's all the experiences he's found across the board that help him solve what he's dealing with at that time. So it's experiences he's gained on the big productions to make the small productions feel big and the projects feel big. At least that's the impression I got listening to the interview. And then also then if you look at the productions he's worked on as well.
Yeah,
and he makes this point, doesn't he, you know, about it's the passion for the production and actually believing in the project. And I mean, there's a phrase he uses, respect and having a good time. And, you know, to be honest, if in any form of employment you've got respect and you're having a good time, it's win-win.
Yeah, and I hope that his process, the same as Kenny and Andrew Hunt and Giles, I hope that, you know, all of their processes, which are different and do vary, because there is no one fixed, solid way of operating, but they should all be acting as a source of inspiration to our listeners who think that world might be the one for them.
Yeah.
We hope you've been enjoying these conversations. We've definitely been enjoying your feedback. If you have any questions or requests for us, please email them to podcast@angels.co.uk. You can visit our website, which is www.angelsbehindtheseams.com, or you can find us on social media. We are on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, just /costumepodcast. And here is Jonathan's chat with David Davenport.
So good afternoon, everybody, and in particular, good afternoon, David. I'm really thrilled that we've got the opportunity to have our chat, and you being stateside, this is kind of a bit early in the morning for you, but not too early.
No, it's fine. It's perfect. I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Just for our audience's sake, David is primarily a North American-based costume supervisor, and he has the most remarkable CV, in my opinion, of any costume supervisor working today, because not only is he highly skilled in what he does, but he has managed to establish a career and reputation working with the very best costume designers that are working today. And I want to talk to David about his career and how it all began and where it has all led to the point that he is at now. So, David, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Take me back to your very early days in terms of coming from Baltimore. What was the first point that you stepped into this business and realized that there is a career to be had here?
I was with my parents one time driving in Washington, D.C. It was summertime, and I must have been 10 or 11. And I looked out the window, and on this over to the right, they were shooting something. There were lights and there was a camera and there was whatever was happening. And I remember seeing that and just thinking, that's what I'm going to do. And I didn't know what that meant, but that intrigued me. And then when I got out of high school, I went to college briefly, and I, through a friend, met a woman who was starting out as a photographer, and she was looking for people to help give free time to do photo shoots so she could build up her resume, her book. And so a makeup artist and a hair person, and my friend Ken knew that I was interested in somehow doing something with a photographer or in commercials or something. I didn't really know, but I knew that's something I wanted to do. So I met this woman, Helen Norman, and ended up being a stylist with her. And we did a lot of test shoots, and then she ended up started getting a lot of work. And then through her, I started working as a stylist. And this was 1984, 85.
Mm-hmm. In Baltimore.
And then I remember I did this one little, it was for a rug company, a nationwide rug company, and it was supposed to be winter, spring, summer, fall, and look how our carpet holds up. And it was a family, and you basically just saw from maybe like knee down, but I had a day to do this. I had to get the people's sizes, and I had to come up with people trudging in from a snowstorm or coming in muddy or coming in you know, flip-flops. And I did it, and I did it really fast, and it looked great. And it was a campaign that they used for a little while. And the producer of that, about a month or two later, called me, and she said, oh, I was out last night at a bar, and I ran into Van Smith, who was John Waters' costume designer, and he's getting ready to do a movie, and he's looking for a team. And I gave him your number, your name. Do you mind if he calls you? And I said, no, please. Wow. I being from Baltimore, I knew who John was. I had not met John at that point. So Van Smith, who was John's costume designer, is the one who created the character of, helped create Divine. He's the one who did Divine's costume.
Right.
He's the one who shaved Divine's eyebrows and did the hair. And so Van called me, and we met at a bar. And I brought my portfolio of, you know, things that I'd styled, and he hired me. And my first movie, my first job in film was the movie Hairspray. And I was the costume supervisor. And I didn't really know what that meant, but it was baptism by fire. I think we had $30,000 to do that movie. And there's a lot of people in that. And we dressed everybody. We dressed everybody head to toe. And I learned as we went along. I really didn't know what I was doing, but for something that scale. And then from that film, I ended up doing a number of movies with Van and John. And Van Smith, I credit where I am today to two people who helped start me, with Van Smith, who was so brilliantly talented. He had started as a sketch artist, and he worked for W and Women's Wear Daily, and he had more. He was incredibly talented, and he really took me under his wing. And I loved working with him because every day we laughed and looked at things differently. And he really taught me what it's like to, he taught me how to be a good customer, to look at people and make them look real. But also, I mean, look, John's movies sometimes are a little over the top, but.
Yeah, it's a heightened reality. And, you know, I want to delve into that a little bit with you in a minute, but go on. Who was the other person that you credit?
And John Waters.
Right.
Because John was a big champion of mine as well. At that time in Baltimore, there was a lot of filmmaking happening. A lot of commercials were being made in the Baltimore, D.C. area, John's movies. And then a number of other movies came into Baltimore. It was the flavor of the month, so to speak. I guess they had a good tax break or something. And I ended up working with some remarkable people. I met Ann Roth in Baltimore. And through that movie, I got into the union, the West Coast Union, and continued to work on the East Coast. I worked in New York. I worked in Baltimore. And I can circle back to this later. But I think for me, what I like to tell people, I feel like I've taken the best of all the worlds of what it means to be a costume supervisor, because different areas, different people do it different ways. Mm-hmm. And it was done one way on the East Coast in the New York area. I then moved to Los Angeles after one of John's movies, a movie called Cry Baby. That was the movie with Johnny Depp. I moved to LA, and 6 months later, that's when they announced they were going to do Edward Scissorhands. And I didn't think I had a chance in hell to be a part of that team, but a friend of mine said, no, come on, you should call. And I called and I spoke to the assistant costume designer, Colleen Kelso, who lives in England. And she set up an interview and I went and I met her and Colleen Atwood at the old Western Costume on Melrose and walked in and we talked and liked one another and they hired me on the spot. And then I was in LA and worked with Colleen Atwood for many, many years on a number of projects. Mm. And I feel like I just went off the, I feel like I didn't answer your question.
No, this is exactly how we want it to flow. What I think is very key about the structure of your career is that you've developed key relationships with designers and it becomes symbiotic between the two of you. Do you get out of sync with a designer in terms of how another designer is able to step in and kind of take over? The introduction to Sandy and then the subsequent kind of amazing relationship and over years and years of projects that you've put together. Does Sandy like keep you going for a number of years and then it gives you the opportunity when something comes along? How does work happen for you?
Usually I'll hear of a project, whether, you know, maybe Sandy has something percolating somewhere and she'll mention it. And so I know that, oh, maybe, you know, maybe in, you know, let's say in September, there might be something. So I'm aware of it. And obviously if it's Sandy calling me and saying there might be this thing, I then kind of put myself on a hold, an unofficial hold. I know that there's something that may be happening. If I got another phone call from somebody else, I would probably say to them, well, there's another project that I might be doing, but you know, I should know soon. I try to kind of stall, to, you know, for a little bit. Mm. I've been fortunate. Most of the time, Sandy and I, our schedules have really worked out. The timing has always been really, really great. There's been a few. Last summer, I did West Side Story. Sandy was back home, and timing worked out for that. And then West Side Story finished in October. On a Friday, and on a Monday morning, I started a job with Sandy. Sandy and I flew to Oklahoma to meet with some people for the project Killers of the Flower Moon, which subsequently fell apart. But it's always worked out. It's funny. It's never been a problem for me working with the people that I enjoy working with. The timing is always. It sounds silly to say it, but the timing has worked out. Sometimes I'll get a call from somebody else and I'll say, oh gosh, I really would love to work with you, but I'm committed to this. And I've been fortunate enough to be committed to working on projects with Sandy a lot because she does amazing projects and she and I have a great working relationship. Mm. And it's fun.
Again, another observation that I've made of your career is that it's not determined by necessarily the scale of the project. I get a sense that it's more to do with the team effort and the collaborative experience. So, for example, if you're on a roll with someone like Anne Roth and you've kind of you go from one project to the other, I get a sense that it's more about the relationship that you have with Anne than necessarily the project. Is that the case?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It's more about, yeah, it's the person. It's Anne or Sandy or Colleen or Kasha. They're doing a project that's interesting. Mm. And it could be a project that there is no money, you know, relatively speaking, you know, very, very small budget, or it can be a big budget. And for me, it's always about how do we crack this nut? How do we, you know, okay, these are the parameters. And that's what I find so exciting about what I do is I get so excited when a project comes to me and the first thing I read the script and then I start thinking about everything. And again, whether it's teeny or giant, that's what I think is so fascinating. How are we going to do this?
And then just taking you back to the world of John Waters, do you think then when you say that you credit the, if you like, that family with how you were able to develop a career, is it because that very unique process that they had as a family of filmmakers? And for the audience that aren't aware, you know, you really need to check into any one of John Waters' films, and you, especially if you do one, and doesn't matter what order, what sequence, but if you go from one to the other and you see an alternative universe evolving through the storytelling and the narrative and the characterizations that is so unique, and so brilliant. And I can't imagine a better grounding for somebody to immerse themselves in our world.
It was such an education, and it wasn't just about, it was about filmmaking. It wasn't, for me, it wasn't just, I was in the costume department, and I was responsible for that, but we were, all of us, we were working with the hair people, we were working with the prop people, we were working, talking with locations and the ADs, and it was this, it truly was a family bringing this project, this story together. And that's today, to this day, that's how I approach my job. I have incredibly close relationships on movies now with the AD department, with locations, with accounting. And I look at it like, this isn't the costume department's problem. This is the movie's problem. We as a team, all of us need to figure out how we're going to do this.
Mm.
And that's, for me, that's the only way you can do it. That's the only, it's about all of us.
Do you see a difference in terms of the working process between the jobs that you have done previously and how the industry is evolving in terms of the myriad sort of forms of not just distribution, but actually production, whether it's through Netflix and HBO and Amazon? You know, is there a shift in terms of management style and the opportunity to collaborate? Or is it sort of going back to more of a factory type process?
I think the collaboration is the same. The thing that's definitely different for all of us is now it's become about numbers and tracking numbers. Whereas before they would say to you, this is your budget, and you just kind of spent the money. And now the costume department has become so much about an accounting department. The amount of paperwork on some of the recent jobs that we've done you need a full-time accounting team, and which basically we have. You know, we always have a coordinator an assistant coordinator who handles paperwork. So that's one. You know, that's definitely one thing that I think has changed. The thing that I'm really curious to see what's going to change now with COVID is how we're going to do our jobs, keep our teams safe, and also keep the actors and the background artists, everybody safe, and also and do it and still have a nice time and make everything look great. The thing I love about film, all of us, what we do in film, is we go in and we get it done, and it looks amazing, and it happens. We can make it happen really fast. So I think this specifically, COVID, I think this is a amazing opportunity for a group of people to figure out this next challenge. That's what filmmaking always is. Mm. Is you go into some town, and it's basically the circus is coming to that town, and you're setting up shop, and you don't know people, and you're creating this fantasy world, and then boom, you're gone. So adding this into it, I think is I think all of us will tackle it really well.
It is fascinating, and it is interesting, and it is about being solution orientated. You know, that philosophy is very much a philosophy that you ascribe to in terms of going into a situation, whether it's on Carol or Far From Heaven, even the Glorias. You know, you hit the ground running. You take stock of the circumstances of where you are. And just as you described, like a circus, you know, you arrive, you take over, you use the resources, the local resources, I presume, where possible, and off you go.
Yes, absolutely. It's funny, you know, a lot of people say what we do as a costume supervisor, it's about your team. And absolutely, it's about your team. But a lot of the times you don't have the luxury of having your team, especially if you are going to another state here in America. Usually the producers, they will say no, you know, you can't bring people from, you know, from wherever, and you have to hire local, which I shouldn't say you have to. I don't mind sometimes the fact that we can't bring people, because obviously if you go to another state, you're going to meet people who are talented and interesting. And you've mentioned Carol, which is a great example. We went to Carol in Cincinnati. It was the dead of winter. It was so cold. I didn't know anybody, and I interviewed a number of people. I hired some people. I hired some people who'd never, ever done it before. And 4 weeks later, we had a full costume shop up and running, and we were doing fittings and alterations. And we did that movie for hardly any money and with a very, very small crew. And again, it was Sandy who designed it, and Christopher Peterson came in and helped do some background fittings. And then it was local people. We brought one customer from New York that we kind of fought for, but that was for Kate, so we got away with that. But I loved that. I love going into a place and meeting new people and putting together, trying to put together a team of people who are going to bring the project alive. And also, most importantly, the thing I always say to people when I meet people, when I'm interviewing people, is we all are going to respect one another and we're going to have a good time. And there's no one's talking behind other people's backs. And this is a team. Outside of the costume trailer, it can be chaos. It can be chaos on the set. But we as a team, I say this on every movie. I said it at the beginning of West Side Story to the entire group. You know, we are a team, all of us. And we have to support one another to get the job done. And I think that's for me, that's the number one thing.
When you're creating your team, let's take Carol as an example. You obviously know, 4 or 5 weeks before you set off to Cincinnati that everything's in place and your timeline from the point of you being contracted to the point where you need to start bringing people in. How do you go about even resourcing? Do you start with theaters, local theaters to where you're going to be shooting? Or do you put a message out on Facebook
I'm not a Facebook person. The first thing I did on that movie when Sandy called me about it and we knew that it was happening, it was greenlit. I was in New York. I got in touch with the Cincinnati Film Commission, which then I think was pretty small, but I asked for a list, send me a list of anybody who has expressed interest. You know, anybody who sent resumes in, I'd like everything related to costume. I then called local theaters and I called local, what I would say, like mom and pop tailor shops. And, you know, from everything, I started off saying, do you have costume rails that you would like to rent? Nobody did, but you know, I want to see what's there. Same thing when we went to Savannah to do the Glorious. That's the first thing I called all these people. What do you have? Do you have industrial sewing machines that I could rent or buy from you? Or do you have dress forms? Or do you have rails or whatever? That's one of the first things, along with seeing who's interested or who's available work-wise. And then I did get a list of names on Carol of people who were interested, who had expressed interest, and I called a number of people. And then I flew to Cincinnati and interviewed a number of people. It's gut instinct. You know, or I'd like to think most of the time, you know, when you meet somebody that you can imagine working 14 hours a day with this person for weeks on end. And then I try to craft a nice group of people.
And then got it all set up. And then someone like Sandy or Anne or whoever arrives and you basically hit the ground running.
Right. Well, usually I will start setting up the costume shop while the designer and the designer team are pulling clothes from rental houses or going to thrift stores, or we're making, depending on what the project is. But I'm setting up the infrastructure and getting the team kind of ready. Mm-hmm. I then am usually remotely overseeing a team like Bridge of Spies, as an example. I was prepping that in New York, but we had a team in London working out of Angels, pulling a huge amount of stuff. We then had a team in Poland. We had a team in Berlin. And then once the project got up and running, in addition to this, I had a small team out on the West Coast because we were going to be shooting at an Air Force base. So setting up the infrastructure, waiting for the clothes to arrive, and then once the clothes arrive, getting everything as fast as possible checked in. We check everything in, make sure everything matches the paperwork. Mm-hmm. And every designer that I've worked with has a different way that they like the room to be set up. You know, some want it by color, or some want it by size, or some want it by whatever. So whatever designer you're working with, I set the room up hopefully to their liking, and then we begin the fittings. You know, the fittings start, and this all happens from getting the phone call to probably fittings start on Carol. That was probably 7 weeks. Yeah, probably 7 weeks. So it's pretty fast on a smaller movie like that.
And what would be the decision behind a film like Carol, which was set in on the East Coast in New York? What would be the decision behind shooting it in Cincinnati?
Money. Cincinnati is an amazing city. It's beautiful. It was the reason we went to Cincinnati was for financial reasons, because they had a great tax break, I assume. But also, more importantly, it looked like New York used to look like. It has buildings that were built in the 20s. They had a lot of money back then, and the architecture is really lovely, and they didn't really screw it up, because nobody really lived there for a long time. Mm. So we were able to go in, and Todd is so amazing. Todd and the production designer were so amazing, because we would be shooting an angle. I would get to set, and I'd say, well, wait, where's the set? And they'd say, oh, that doorway right there. If you look to the left, there might be a modern something, and to the right there is a modern something, but we're just shooting the way he shoots the angles. It was amazing. That movie, Carol, I am so incredibly proud of for what Sandy and our team and I did. Again, we really had no money. We were working with people we hadn't worked with before. And we had to use a lot of the same crowd over and over again, because we didn't have the clothing. But, you know, every day we'd need 30, 40, 60, 100 people. So we kept kind of recycling people, maybe changing coats, but, and then just watching the faces. And that's one thing that I do that I guess a lot of supervisors don't do. I'm there on the set. I am watching through one of the monitors what we are seeing, because I feel like I represent Sandy when Sandy's not there. Sandy's always there to establish a costume, but yeah. I'm there, you know, making sure that the ADs don't, oh, we need 10 people for the scene. And that inevitably, and ask any costume person this, inevitably the ADs will go over and they will pull four people, and they will pull four people that are all wearing the same color. They always do that. I don't know why. So if I'm in a town and I don't know my set costumers, it's not their job to be making maybe that decision. And I usually have I work very closely with the ADs. They like to have me, I would say, a part of that process. We always kind of, I like to say, we kind of, you know, paint the room with people and make it look right.
That's a very unique take on the job title that you have, because that's kind of unusual. And it's fantastic to know that is a possibility as somebody who takes on the job of costume supervision, because normally the association is that that's the job that you've just described, as you said, is handled by a set person. And I think that it's very key that the opportunity is there, if one should want it, to be able to step into that realm and have the confidence of the designer, but also the confidence of the ADs and director and everyone that's sort of choreographing the moments. And on that basis, because you're interested in the process of filmmaking, I presume then that you completely understand the concept of continuity and, you know, and how that all works within the bigger picture.
Sure. I think the only way you can be a good supervisor is if you started out as a set person. I think the reason that I am a good supervisor is because I was on set for many years. And I'll say I was a really good set person, and I loved it. I do think being a set person is a younger person's game. It's incredibly grueling, and it's very stressful. The decision you are making right then can affect things. If you mess up on the continuity, it's not good, and you do not want that to happen. So I can't imagine being a supervisor and never having been a set person. And I will say I'd been a supervisor for many, many, many years. Had not been a set costumer for many, many years. And then a few years ago, Ann Roth called me and said, I'm doing this movie with Meryl Streep. Would you consider coming in and dressing her? And I didn't have anything happening then. I said, sure, I'd love to. I'd worked with Meryl before, so I knew her, but I'd never been her costumer. So I went in and I was her set costumer. And it was so invaluable as a supervisor to step back into that role, because I realized what a set person needs is to be supported by their supervisor. They need to know that if they ask for something, it's taken seriously, and the person is going to listen to them and help them, because you are in the line of fire when you are the set person. Mm. And I forgot how hard it was. So I would say to any supervisor out there, go back to set, or, you know, be a set customer for a day. And it was an eye opener, and it really made me appreciate set people so much more again, because it's a hard job.
So as you progress through the ranks and kind of accomplished everything at the point that you've needed to then move on to the next stage, have you aspirations to design your own work?
None whatsoever. I did one short many years ago, right after we finished shooting Edward Scissorhands. Johnny and I became good friends, and he was doing a little tiny movie, and he asked me to be the costume designer, which I designed. It starred Susan Terrell. I don't know whatever happened to that movie, and it was fun. I loved working with Johnny and with the actors, but truthfully, that's not my strong point. I'm so much better supporting a designer, and I've been so fortunate to work with such incredibly talented people. Sure, I could design something, but I would rather work with somebody who's brilliant and be on these amazing projects. And going back to the support thing, that's what I do. My job is I support the designer and their vision and the director. You know, that's what we do.
But also how fantastic that your directors over the years, the aristocracy of the film industry, from Scorsese through to Waters.
No, I've been very fortunate.
What was the experience like with West Side Story?
West Side Story was amazing. I had worked with Mr. Spielberg before on Bridge of Spies with Kasha Mamoni, the designer. So I knew Steven, and I knew his producer and some of his people, and Janosch, the DP. So West Side Story, I also, the producer, unit production manager, and a lot of the team on West Side Story, I'd worked with a lot of them. So it was almost kind of like family again. And Paul Tazewell was the designer. Paul and I had never worked together before, and we had a great relationship. It was an amazing movie. Paul has done an incredible amount of theater, and he, this was, I believe, his second movie. So I tried to put together a team that would support him and his vision, and that was big. We built everything for all the dancers, and there was a lot of rental as well. But the whole experience was great. It was hard. We shot last summer, and last summer was very, very hot in New York City. And we shot out on the streets every single day, and getting, you know, anywhere from 50 to 250 people dressed who were dancing their guts out on asphalt pavements over and over and over again. And then turning around that clothing overnight to a different location, you know, yet another church basement somewhere. So we had a huge team of really talented people who, you know, this team is loading into tomorrow's location, and this team is pulling out yesterday's location, and this team is working overnight, getting the stuff refreshed and cleaned, and then we had the full workroom, and then the full background fitting world. It was a big army, and I think we really nailed it. I think Stephen was very happy. The dancers were happy, the choreographer was happy, and it was a great experience.
I'm looking forward to seeing it, because the very notion of remaking, you know, such a definitive movie is so intriguing. Were you part of the sort of initial tone meetings and conversations about concept and how this production was going to present a different perspective on how it had originally been created?
No, I was not. Paul had already had the meetings with Stephen, and had presented kind of how he envisioned it. He had some amazing sketch artists do a lot of artwork, and then he met with Stephen, and that's how they together. I was never part of those meetings, but from that, then we knew, you know, this is the color palette for these people. This is the color palette for this group or this background. And so each, the way Paul did it, different scenes were different tones.
Yeah.
So meanwhile, we then had a team pulling clothes, pulling specifically for the different looks, so to speak. So then when the clothing came in, all the clothing was sorted by color and by tone, and then when the background people were fit, that was very, very controlled, incredibly controlled.
So then a brilliant choice to go for more of a theatrical, creative concept by going with Paul. And for our audience, Paul Tazewell is also, his claim to fame as amongst many shows is Hamilton. And the color concept on Hamilton is absolutely genius in terms of the tones and how it moves through the piece. And I would imagine that that would have been one of the kind of prerequisite requirements in terms of an ability of having that concept of colour, because West Side Story is defined by its different worlds of colour.
Right. And it was so, you know, the original West Side Story is mostly studio, where this is, it's out on real streets with real buildings, but then putting people in the costumes, everything worked. It felt very real, but it also felt heightened and alive, very vibrant and alive, but in the real location.
You've come full circle in your career. You've come back to the heightened reality.
Yeah, true.
Actually, even Todd uses Far From Heaven, you know, the colors that the Douglas Sirk color palette was just so incredible and sort of and popping.
Well, that's the cool thing about Todd and all. You didn't ask this question, but the one thing that I think is so exciting about what I do is in the very beginning of a production, obviously you read the script and you start figuring out the budget and you start having meetings with producers about things like that. But for me, the first thing I want to do when I get into the office is if I don't know the production designer, I want to meet the production designer and I want to see their boards. I want to see their research. I want to see the world, the story they are telling, because that dictates the story that what are we going to provide to inhabit these spaces? So usually a lot of people put up, you know, they'll put up just photographs, tons of photographs all over the wall. This is the feel for this scene. This is the feel for that scene. Todd Haynes puts together a beautiful book. The whole movie is there kind of tonally or, you know, feeling wise. And so me as the costume supervisor, I want to see that stuff because then I better understand what I need to do and what we need to do. And then taking that a step further, when the production goes out on a technical scout or a recce, I always go on that. And in the beginning, people would say, why, what, this is so weird. Why are you here? And I always say, well, how can you be the costume supervisor and not go on the technical scout with the grip guy and the electric and the DOP and the director and the first AD and hear them say what the movie they are shooting. I need to hear that, because then the costume designer is busy. The costume designer can't be doing that. And then I can come back and I can say to Sandy, oh, when we shoot the scene that's supposed to be the pool behind the Howard Johnson's, it's about this big and this is the feel of it, and I'll take pictures. So that way, way before we even go to do that thing, the designer knows and my fitting team knows this is what it's going to look like. And then they've also now gone and looked at the production designers and the art directors. They've seen the world that we need to now populate. So I think it's like this whole, maybe family is not the right word, but it's this whole group. And we all are making the same thing.
And I would imagine nowhere more necessary than in a movie like The Irishman, where your locations were kind of all over the place, weren't they?
They were all over the place. I mean, that was a beast in that it was every single day for the most part, we were in a different location. You know, just the logistics of getting everything in and out and where it needs to be. But truthfully, that's my favorite part of what I do. I love those big, giant movies where there are so many moving parts and so many people and the workshop and the fitting team and the prep team and all of that. And just, you know, I'm kind of aware of everything. I like to think I'm aware of everything, and it's like an umbrella. And then I'm you know, overseeing the numbers, the money, but also again, you know, I have to know what's happening on set and what we're shooting and what we're seeing.
And tell me, is there a preference then with something like West Side Story, as you just described, as a huge amount of work on the streets, and then something like Mary Poppins, which primarily is all send, or even Hugo, where it's all centered around the studio. So you're transferring one world into another world. Is there a preference for you?
Yes, I prefer location shooting. I think there are more variables, and I like that you just have to think on your feet. Shooting in a studio, it can be nice, but a soundstage for me that's built to look like a street is not the same thing as going to the street where you, I mean, it sounds pokey, but the wind is blowing the leaves and you feel the real temperature, and around the corner is something that you don't want to see, but it, that to me is, it's exciting. That's like magic.
Mm.
A soundstage is a different type of magic.
It's a controllable magic.
Yeah.
So on West Side Story, how did they get the Upper West Side in terms of time and place? How did that, without giving anything away, because we're all dying to see it, but how, if you're in New York and you're shooting locations, did that mean that you're kind of on Long Island City, or, because even that's got its own distinctive architecture, isn't it?
It does. We were predominantly in Manhattan, northern Manhattan, or in the Bronx. And I think most every single thing out on the street was, other than cleaning it up, so to speak, getting rid of maybe, satellite dishes and things like that. The architecture hasn't really changed. So again, being out on the street, the real street with the real buildings, is so cool. It's so exciting because it's, but you're right. I don't want to give too much away.
Everyone always thinks of New York as the metropolis that's sort of, you know, shining, gleaming, but actually the step back off of the shining, gleaming, and you've got architecture, which, yeah, I suppose you're right. Essentially hasn't changed since almost the turn of the last century.
Yeah, a lot, yeah. The hardest part, and going back to Carol, the hardest part is, if you don't have a lot of money, is finding things that have contemporary awnings or contemporary signage or things like that. That's why Cincinnati worked so well, because it didn't have that. They didn't have to go in and clean that out if you don't have a lot of money, whereas you do have money on a bigger project, so you have time to go in and really kind of dress the set and make it look appropriate.
And when it comes to your clothing and your suppliers and the relationships that you have with facilities like Angels and Western Costume, do you always have a preference to use clothing that has pre-existed rather than recreating new where you can? I mean, obviously, you know, where you've got heavy choreography and I presume clothing was either bought or created specifically for fit for purpose, but do you have a passion? Do you ever go into the costume houses and do the pull and the sourcing?
I used to. I haven't done it for a few years now, mainly because there aren't really any costume houses in New York anymore. There's a few small ones, but small. There's nothing of Angel scale. So usually if I'm prepping a movie, even if it's a movie, let's say initially when we started prepping Hugo or Mary Poppins, I probably worked a little bit in New York first, working on a budget before I went over there. So a lot of times you'll have a team already starting, you'll put a team in place, starting to pull things. But I used to pull, yeah, back years ago when I was in LA, when I worked with Colleen Atwood, I pulled clothes, and Roth, I pulled stuff, but it's been a while. Do I care for one over the other? It's each project. It's more about what the project demands or calls for. I think originally on West Side Story, maybe people were thinking, oh, wouldn't it be great? We can just rent clothes because it won't cost any money. But then when you explain to people, well, if you rent old clothing, which is that clothing has been sitting on a rack for 60, 70 years, and you put a warm, perspiring human being into that clothing and you put them out on the streets, that stuff's not going to hold up. That's why, yeah, it's going to cost more money up front on paper to make the thing, but it's going to last and it's going to look, it's going to be what the designer wants. It's going to be what the director wants. It's controlled and it'll hold up over and over again over a hot, sweaty summer. So, you know, sometimes, yeah, you do want to, you'd love to be able to find old clothing that has been worn and aged and naturally and looks right. Making new things or buying new things and then trying to make them look like they're not new things, unless you have an incredibly talented team of doing breaking down, it can look horrible. That group, John Cowell, for instance, whether it's on something like Mary Poppins or something like The Aviator, people like John are so amazing because they can take something that is brand new that, you know, just came off the table yesterday and then to put it on the actor then and it doesn't look like it was just made,
yeah.
I think.
That's such a skill. And in fact, that is something that we're going to be addressing in terms of our chats, because I think that the age of dying process is absolutely vital to especially now that so much is created in film and television in high definition. And it's beholden on the supervisor designer to be so aware of the final completion of a characterization by, you know, the patina of what they're wearing.
Yes.
It's so glaring when you see somebody that hasn't quite grasped that or hasn't had time to grasp it or doesn't have the budget, and they send out a performer right. in something that literally looks like they've taken off the rack of a men's store that morning. It's a very unforgiving world in that respect.
Indeed, indeed.
So, David, this has been amazing, and I'm so thrilled to have had this opportunity to kind of get this bit of insight into your world and career. But have you got a single piece of advice that you would offer to somebody that wanted to fall into your shoes?
Specifically to be a costume supervisor?
Yeah, yeah.
Be a great set person. That's the first thing. If you have to have been, in my opinion, have been a set person and know what continuity is, know who all the players on the set are. You need to understand how a day unfolds and how to care for costumes and how to work with the actors and how to work with the background actors. And if you have done that and you like doing it and you like also organization and kind of help with the bigger picture, then, oh, Jonathan, I don't know. I don't know how to answer this question.
Well, you kind of answered it because the most single piece of advice would be to learn your craft, be curious, take on the bigger picture, and see where it takes you. Be open.
Yeah, yes. I think another thing is if you want to be a supervisor, you have to want to lead a team of people. You have to, I think, get joy from it. And I truly do. I love putting together a group of people. And nothing makes me prouder at the end of a show that we've brought together all these people who maybe didn't know each other before, and then you've made all these new friends and you've learned something. And that, if that sounds exciting to you, then yeah, then pursue this. But if the idea of overseeing a budget and overseeing people, and truthfully, the hardest thing that a supervisor does is the people, because, you know, it is long hours and it can be grueling, and you are the person that has to kind of be the team leader and make, you know, how can we get to the end and still enjoy one another? If that sparks something in you, then you should be a supervisor. To me, it's like the next logical step from having been a set person and enjoying all of that. Well, what's the next thing to do? Well, now I want to kind of like, I want to oversee it all. And I want to put together a team that enjoys one another and respects one another and has a good time. And I know I've said that word over and over again in our conversation, respect, but I think that's so incredibly important in what we do. Again, for people who don't work in film or who have not worked in it yet, the average crew person, whether it's costume or prop or makeup or whatever, by the end of the movie, the team that you've worked with, you know them better than most people know someone that they've worked in an office with for 3 years, because the amount of time you've spent together is so huge. And it's about liking that lifestyle. You know, you are away from home. You leave the house on West Side Story. I was leaving my house at 4:30 every morning, and I was getting home usually around 8 o'clock at night or 9 o'clock at night, or, you know, something long hours. You really have to have a passion for filmmaking.
How much downtime do you give yourself as a rule? Once a project's finished,
there's never a set thing. If there's another project that is interesting, I'll go and do it. I mean, there's been maybe sometimes it's been too much. There was about a 3.5-4 year period when I went literally from one job to the next, and then towards the end of that, I thought, okay, I have to take a break. And then fortunately, it worked out. I was able to. But like I was saying earlier in the conversation, I finished West Side Story on a Friday, and I was on a plane Monday morning to meet Sandy to start another project. So sometimes you don't get a break. But that's, you know, if it's amazing though. At the end of a project, sometimes I'll get wind of another one, and then I get so excited. That's so exciting. It's like, oh, okay, how are we going to do this? What year is it taking place in? What year? Okay, where is it shooting? And that. That is, it's so exciting.
I was sort of aiming to wrap up the conversation, but I've got one last question that I wanted to ask you. When the call came through from West Side Story, was that a call from Paul, or was it a call from the production checking your availability and then setting up a meeting between you and Paul?
About a year before West Side Story, when they were kind of starting thinking about it, I had worked with the producer before, and he called me and said, this is probably going to happen. Will you do a budget for me? And that happens a lot. I've done budgets for a lot of movies that I haven't worked on or movies that haven't happened, mm-hmm. but I pride myself in usually being pretty accurate about a budget. And with a budget, that's not just for the spends for, oh, this is how much it's going to cost to rent and this is how much it's going to cost to buy, but I also do the labor budget. So I'll ask for, give me a script and give me some type of schedule and tell me how many extras, what's the biggest extra day, how many people. And then from that, usually takes me 4 days, 4 or 5 days. I'll do a full breakdown, figure out what I think it's going to cost, what the labor is going to be. And that happened to me in West Side Story about a year before. So I'd already done kind of a budget, and they said to me, oh, like, that's crazy, it's too much money. And I said, well, I'm just taking, you tell me what you want, how many people, and I'll tell you what I think it's going to cost. And if you don't want to spend that much money, then you don't have as many people. So that had already happened. So then as it got closer to them actually gearing up for production, they hired Paul, and they told Paul, we had already talked to David about possibly doing this, and would you meet with him? So I met with Paul, and I said, look, you do not know me. I get it. Please, I want you, I want you to have who you would like to have in your department. And he said, no, I'd love to have you. So that was great. I was very fortunate. And then we continued to do our thing.
Yeah, great. I think especially for someone like Paul, who's not that familiar with the process of filmmaking because of where he comes from, especially on the scale that you've just been describing, it would be in his best interest to have somebody of your proficiency, kind of supporting him along the way. And I think that that's probably the reason why it was such a joyous experience, because you both completely understood where the other was coming from.
Yeah. I think also the relationship the designer and the supervisor has, it is about trust. If you don't have the trust, it would be very difficult. And if you've worked with the designer over and over again, there's this unspoken thing. You don't even need to talk about things. Like, that's why Sandy and I have such a great relationship, because we just go in and do it. But then when you start a new project with someone you've never worked before, like the project with Paul and I didn't know one another, but you just kind of have to, the way I look at it, it's like, well, how can I serve this vision? How can I make this happen and trust that what I'm doing is what the designer wants? And fortunately with that, it worked out.
You're doing yourself a discredit. I think that you have a particularly unique take on I've mentioned it before, but the bigger picture. And I think a lot of that comes from your training and your background and the fortunate environment that you were able to move your way through. And, I know that you credit it in the sense that you've referred to it in this conversation. And I know that, I started on that because I know that much about you, because we've mentioned it before. And I think that it's absolutely key in terms of how one progresses through this business by not just curiosity, but by paying attention and asking questions, but making sure that they're the right questions. Think about what it is you need to know, and also when to ask that question is almost as important.
Well, learning diplomacy. Yeah. Like you just said, you have to know when to ask the questions, but more importantly, you have to know when not to talk. And it's about listening. Yeah. I try to be aware of what's going on, and it's, just don't talk. You'll get the information. People, that's why I always go on a tech scout, because you're never going to get this information. I want to go there and I want to hear it. I want to hear it in real time. It's not specifically for, this is for the costume department to know that blah, blah, blah. I know what we're doing.
It's not a process that can be done through telepathy.
No. One thing that I'm incredibly proud of, and it's on every single job that I've ever done, I know background artists, the people who are extras in movies, a lot of times what I've heard is they're not treated well. I'm not going to say by costume departments, but just a lot of times they're just moved around kind of like cattle. Mm-hmm. And I take great pride I want my team and our team treats the background artist with as much care and respect as we do the main actor. And the number of extras that have come up to me at the end of a day, a long shooting day, and this could be in Cincinnati or London or Berlin or Poland or Los Angeles, and come up to me or my team and said, and shook my hand, which we probably won't do anymore, but shook my hand and thanked me. Thank you so much for being so polite to us and so nice to us. And I think that, again, it's one of the most important things. Let's just all, yes, we are making a movie and it's stressful and, you know, we got to get the shot, but let's be kind to one another.
That's a very, very good piece of advice. Kindness.
It sounds so, does it sound stupid or does it sound simple? I don't know, but it's just like, we can get it done and it's going to look great. And let's be kind to each other. Mm-hmm. And that's what, you know, Jonathan, you know, you and I know each other through the years. And like every time that you and I have dealt with each other, it's like, just about respect and liking one another it doesn't even have to be liking one another. It's just being respectful. And that's what I'm proud of. That's what I'm most proud of, that we always have a nice experience. People like one another and we're all proud of what we've done together.
Is there a member of your team that you've brought through the ranks that's chomping at your heels and calls you up out of the blue, you know, and says, I want you over here. Can you do this? And you say, I can't, I'm just about to start. But you know, do you believe that there's an opportunity for you to pass the baton and kind of and say to Anne, look, maybe you should be talking to this person? You know, how does that work?
A number of years ago, and maybe this will answer your question, I don't know. A number of years ago, I met this young man. People told me, oh, you should meet him. He's smart and he's a good guy and he wants to do this. And he was working in New York as a production assistant in the costume department. So you're very limited to what you can and can't do. You can get coffee or you can drive a car or go do a pickup, but you can't touch clothing. And I knew that he wanted to be a costumer and I was finishing up a job. We didn't have money and I needed a PA for about 3 weeks and it was not glamorous. It was probably summer and hot. It was packing boxes or something, not fun. And I said to him, will you come and do this for me? It's for 3 weeks. It's not going to be great. The money's horrible, but I promise you my next job, if you're interested, I will help you and get you in as a customer. And he said yes. So the next job was the Wolf of Wall Street. And he was my men's customer. I kind of like, I sometimes believe it's like sink or swim. You know, obviously if you've already, you know the person, you've met them, you see how they are, you know their personality, and you can tell people either have it or they don't. And so I kind of like pushed him off the edge and he did a great job. And then he and I continued to work together. And then he has gone on to be a background supervisor on a couple jobs and very successful. Good. So there's not that many people that it's funny. There's not that many people who really want to do this. At least they tell me a lot of people are just happy to not have the responsibility. I think a lot of people don't want the responsibility of having to deal with both the team, which is one thing, but then also a lot of production and dealing with producer and dealing with accounting. And, you know, it's just some people aren't interested in that. But
that's what I think so interesting about this series of chats that we're conducting, because there are so many different levels of input and roles that can be created. You know, people that don't know about the industry of costume design just see costume design, but they don't realize how multi-layered it is. And just as much as they don't realize how multi-layered it is, practitioners themselves can quite happily create a career for themselves, exactly as you've just described, and taking whatever aspect of the business they choose. As long as they do what they do with integrity and honesty and, as you say, David, kindness.
Yes. And that's what's so cool about costuming. There's so many different things to do. You know, there are amazing costumers who know how to pull a show, and that's what they love doing. They have no desire to go to set. They have no desire to have that world. But if I got a call today for a movie that's taking place in London, there are two people that I would call to go to your place, Angels, to start pulling, because they... not only are they really, really good, but they love it. like that's exciting for them. But then there's other people who, oh my God, I want to be on set. I love that. Or I want to be painting the clothes, or I want to make the clothes. And so, yeah, there's so many different opportunities.
And just to finish off, David, what I would say is that to be an effective manager, based on what you've just said, is recognizing the strengths of those people and playing to them and not trying to put a square peg in a round hole.
Absolutely, yes.
And on that note...
So that was Jonathan's conversation with David. Jonathan, I thought that was a great interview. And again, it's someone I've not met before that you've interviewed that I'd love to meet and work with.
Inspiration.
I'm very good at putting rabbits out of hats, aren't I? About the third person that you've never heard of.
I'm not sure who that reflects worse on, me or...
It's like there's a parallel industry here.
Jonathan's industry.
Some of us are bimbling along.
It was a great conversation. And again, it's someone who was very thoughtful with his answers and believes it. And Richard, you said it earlier and he said it in the interview. It comes across, he has such passion for what he does and this industry.
And I just kept writing down quotes, you know, these aphorisms about, you know, we're all in it together, we're not to ask questions, you know, support the designer, all these things, which of course are obvious, but sometimes they aren't kind of articulated, maybe.
I think what you glean from David as well is that ultimately he's incredibly discreet,
and
that makes him trustworthy because he's very careful about, you know, the world that he functions within in terms of maintaining balance and relationships. And when you consider what access to information we all have to varying degrees in terms of not just celebrity, but the whole concept of non-disclosure and information and what people are interested in, what the general public are interested in terms of how this industry functions. And I think for somebody who has worked on such broad range of high profile projects with important casts and important filmmakers, I think that, you know, he's got great stories to tell, but they're done with discretion.
And the other thing, it's not always the nicest thing to say, but on a film set at times, knowledge is power. But David doesn't come across as a person who would abuse that sort of power. He wants to share it with everyone because it's for the benefit of the production, the benefit of his department, and makes for a far better working environment.
Yes,
I like the fact that he likes to go out on locations, you know, just to go and look at where they're actually going to be doing these things beforehand, as opposed
to... Well, he sees that as a vital function the department, because that's what establishes his relationships with assistant directing team and controls casting. If it's a location, then local casting. And because of that, if you like, inside understanding, it enables him to span the world of large and small scale projects.
And bridge the gap. I also like the fact that he says, you know, he spends time on set, which again is, you know, is often a complaint from supervisors. You know, they don't get a chance to actually get up to the sharp
or find the
sharp sticky end quite as often as they'd like to.
How can they know what they're supervising if they're not all over every aspect of what it is that they're being supervised?
The next episode that we will be releasing is Rich's conversation with Chris Silk.
Closer to home.
Yes, much closer to home. Yes, we've gone from across the Atlantic to across the corridor. Chris, of course, is now our head of uniform department here. And I don't really want to preempt the interview too much, but obviously he is, I think, one of our success stories from apprentice to where
Definitely.
He is now. And again, I think it's an interesting interview and yet another facet, another insight into how people become part of this business, this industry of ours.
And here is a small excerpt of Richard's chat with Chris Silk.
Every afternoon, each week, we'd all of these sort of like trainees and apprentices all get pulled aside into a side office, and there would be a group of mannequins laid out, and we also were given a handout sort of explaining the kind of key points that separates this particular style of suit from, say, a 40s one from a 50s one. And we did a whole load of those, say a sort of span from, I don't necessarily think we did a huge amount on sort of ancient Rome, but we sort of starting from sort of medieval, really, up to the sort of 60s, 70s, up to contemporary.